Hey, this is Eddie Spaghetti from the greatest rock and roll band in the world, the Supersuckers.
Hey, this is Joe from the Mises.
This is Adam Franklin from Slow Driver.
This is Artie Lang from the Howard Stern Show.
Hey, this is John from the Fed.
Hey, this is Rick Kubik, drummer from Natarone.
This is Josh Hayden from Spain.
Matt Sharp from The Rentals, and you are listening to...
And you're listening to The Dark Stuff Podcast.
And you're listening to The Dark Stuff Podcast.
The Dark Stuff Podcast.
Hey everybody, it's me, Dave Splash, from thedarkstuff.com and the Dark Stuff Podcast. I'm back with podcast 115. This episode, I'll be interviewing a really, really talented guy that I've known for quite some time. We have some personal history, goes back some 20 years, and we're going to address all of that as well as address the present. The interviewee on this episode is David Rosenheim. Now, Dave Rosenheim, you may or may not know, from his band in the 90s called Hue. Hue put out four or five albums in the 90s, a number of singles, and broke up at the very, very end of the decade. Since that time, Dave has gone on and recorded a solo record under the name The Weather Band, and he's reemerged recently with a new group called Winchester Revival. Now, this group, Winchester Revival, it was a group that was already going when Dave joined, and he'll tell the story about that. He's always been a guitar player and singer. In this group, he just sings. So, during the interview, we talk about the current band and their goals for the future, which is to record three different EPs within the span of about a year and a half, then possibly at the end of that, compile them into a full-length record. They'd like to do some brief spurts of touring, but as you'll hear in the interview, all of these guys have pretty packed lives, so it's very difficult to, you know, get back in the van and do a tour 90s style, which is the way that that Dave and his old band Hue used to do. He and I know one another because in my past life, I had an independent record label called Mafia Money Records from about 1994 until 2000. I released about 16 or 17 different releases, included full-length albums on CD and 7-inch vinyl singles. Dave and his band Hue were the first band that I ever worked with. The debut Mafia Money release was a Hue 7-inch single, Crush, backed with Henry's Daughter. So obviously we go back a long ways. So we're going to talk about the current band, Winchester Revival, talk about his current projects, including the fact that in addition to being a singer in the band, he also heads an environmental nonprofit. And we'll talk a little bit about that in the interview. We'll also go into the backstory, and we're going to review the old Hue records from the 90s, and Dave gives his thoughts and reflections on the making of them and what he thinks about the records today. So let's go ahead and get into the interview. This is podcast number 115, The Dark Stuff Interviews Dave Rosenheim.
We'll start going with the new band, Winchester Revival.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the story? What's the name about? How did you guys meet? Who's in the band, etc.?
Yeah, you know, I don't have a good story for the name. So what happened was the band formed, geez, I don't know, maybe a year and a half or a couple years before I joined. And the core of the band that started, the two guys that started it were Andy Lund and Ron Cruz. And Andy Lund is an old friend of mine and somebody that I've played music with for a long time. We haven't actually played in bands together. Although
I know the name. He was in a different band, right?
His band was Spackle when I was in Hue.
Right, okay. Spackle.
And he's since been in a whole bunch of bands, including Lower 48. He played in a band with Gavin Foster, as you know, who was also in here, called Guilt Trip City. That was like just a prog rock freak out improvisational thing. And Sons of Oswald, he's done like a fair amount of kind of punk metal stuff. Anyway, these guys started it. They originally had a different drummer, and that didn't work out, and they brought on Kirk. They originally wanted a female singer, and I heard some of the stuff that they were doing, and I liked it right away, and I started getting ideas for the lyrics and melodies. And
was it seeing them play, or they were just like playing you?
No, they were just. I just heard. You know, he just sent me some of the stuff they had recorded in the practice studio, and it immediately, you know, kind of got. I wrote a song, or I wrote the lyrics and the melody on top of something that they had already written. And Andy's sort of like, oh, yeah, well, we want to find a girl, you know. That took a while. And then, you know, before he came crawling back to me, begging me to, no, I'm just kidding. But, you know, he sent me some more stuff. And by this time, Kirk, who's our drummer now, was playing with them. And Kirk's awesome drummer. And they sent me more stuff, and it was, you know, also very inspiring, and I got ideas right away for it. And this was just, you know, again, them sending me MP3s of what they were doing and me, you know, recording it at home and just coming up with ideas for the vocals. And around the time that I joined, or a little bit before I joined, Matt Glick, the guy who plays, he programs sounds. So he plays some keyboard, like on a Moog, but it's more programmed computer sounds.
Okay, I saw on a photo that you guys have on Facebook, it has he's the one doing the computer, like with the laptop up there. Right. Okay.
Exactly. So he had just joined, and when I started practicing with them, and that was, I don't know, a year and a half ago or something like that. And we just, you know, we it was a great creative. It still is a great creative kind of rebirth for me, certainly, and for, you know, some of the other guys. More recently, just in the past really few weeks, we've started playing and recording with a woman, Amanda, who is singing, and she also plays other instruments, so she might eventually play some stuff as well. But the new EP that we're mixing right now has some of her vocals on it. So we're up to six people at this point.
Is she doing, like, separate songs than you, or you guys are both sort of working at the same time?
Right now, she's more singing harmony and backup to me.
Okay.
But, you know, perhaps eventually she'll do some, you know, branch out a little bit and do some more of her own stuff, or play more of a lead vocal, or sing more of a lead vocal, I should say. Yeah.
Now, you don't play guitar at all in this band.
No, I haven't. I haven't been a singer only since I was in high school, and it's simultaneously awkward. I think I'm getting over the awkwardness, you know, not to have an instrument live,
right,
especially. But it's also really liberating for my writing, for the lyrics, which to me are really the most important thing. I've been writing, you know, a lot of poetry over the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, and, you know, the words are really important. And not to be kind of bound by my own, you know, kind of guitar habits and limited chordal vocabulary is awesome. So these guys are coming up with stuff, and I hear it. I write the melody and the words on top of it. I might rearrange some of the parts. You know, I influence, obviously. We all kind of influence the arrangement.
Right.
So it's a very different creative process for me, and so far it's working really well.
Find a way to warm itself.
Now, how often are you guys playing out? I mean, I know you had a show a little while ago. That's where I saw the picture from. But how often do you guys perform?
You know, not a whole lot. I think we've had, I don't know, half a dozen shows or something in our history. We just played our, we released our first EP in May and played a record release show that was great in San Francisco. And then just a week or two ago, we played, we actually opened for The Fix.
Remember
those guys.
Absolutely, I remember those guys. I saw a couple of their records.
Yeah, they were great, by the way. They were awesome. We opened for them at the Sweetwater Music Hall, which is kind of a legendary venue in Mill Valley, north of San Francisco, a couple weeks ago, and that was a great show, really fun.
All right. So is that something that you guys want to do more, or is this pretty much the way it's gonna be, just kind of sporadic playing due to basic time constraints and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think realistically it'll be sporadic playing. You know, if the records, when I say records, I mean, you know, digital, downloads.
Ones and zeros.
I should say, if the audience gets some traction, you know, I think we'd all love to play more, but we all have, you know, a few of us have families, and we all have, you know, very busy day jobs and stuff like that. So I think we'd like to play as much as we practically can.
Yeah. So what are, you have the first EP out, and I've noticed, you know, it's gotten some good reviews, and I played a little bit on the show. I played it twice. Not all the way through, obviously, but songs from it. And you said you have a new one coming out already. So what's next on the agenda for the band? I mean, what are the goals, I guess? How frequently can you put out music and
our idea is to do three EPs in as rapid sequence as we can. And like I said, you know, the first EP was just released in May. We're hoping to get the second one out this fall, so that would be pretty quick. And then we're just starting to write the third one. The second EP is longer than the first. It's actually got six tracks on it, so it's more of a sort of a mini album.
Okay.
But you know, the idea is to get these out quickly and to kind of build on it. We actually got some decent college radio play on the first one. I just today got a whole big clutch of new reviews from our PR person who's working it, and so I'm psyched about that. I haven't even read them yet. And you know, the hope is, yeah, just kind of build on it as best we can. I like the idea of doing three EPs and then doing kind of a summary full length that includes summer or all of the tracks from those three EPs at some point. Hopefully we'll continue to record and stuff. But right now the goal is to do three sort of within an 18 to 24 month period.
Okay. And so the idea of doing a full length album is still something that appeals to this band. I mean, I talked to a lot of different artists who are these days just saying, like, what's the point in putting out a whole album? You know, they'd like to put out 3-4 songs just real quickly, directly, digital, and it's easier to work it that way. They don't have to come up with the whole piece of an album. I mean, I'm not endorsing that idea by any means because I like an album, but...
Yeah. You know, I got to say, I mean, that's kind of our thinking on this. A lot of it has to do with time, money, and also, you know, if you release fewer songs, there's less room for crap songs.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of end up with the gems. So the format, the EP format's working for us right now. And like I said, I mean, kind of we have this concept of doing three. We might go to a longer format after that. I don't know. I don't know where we'll go. But right now, you know, yeah, like I said, I mean, we you know, you can do 4 to 6 songs in a real studio without thinking a ton of money. And the first EP we didn't go to a real studio. We did it in our practice space, and Ian Swanky, who you remember from Hue, engineered the mix and did a great job. This time
it sounds good. It certainly doesn't sound like it was recorded in some garage or something. I mean, it sounds
I mean, part of it is that Ian has really good outboard gear and stuff. But now we're in a you know, professional studio that has amazing vintage analog gear, outboard gear, and it sounds really good. I'm psyched for you to hear it eventually.
Yeah, so that's what you're working on next. That's the next EP.
Yep.
Is the next EP. Okay. So touring beyond playing in the Bay Area is pretty much off the table, you'd probably say.
I wouldn't say it's off the table. I mean, I think that we would... I could envision us doing, you know, short bursts. You know, maybe if we, you know, had a week or a long weekend on the East Coast at some point, that would be great. It's certainly not that hard for us to get to L.A., but doing the kind of touring that I used to do, you know, go out for 2 months at a time, I can't see doing that unless there's, you know, unless it pays for itself.
Right.
And pays for my mortgage at the same time, you know.
Yeah, can you, you know, I interview all these young bands and, you know, going out on their first big tour or something like that. Can you imagine just to think, like, how much easier it is today, it seems like, just because of cell phones and the internet.
Oh, my God.
It is so much easier to do things. I mean, I asked a girl in this band how they booked their tour, and it was all emailing people.
Right.
All you have to do is send a link. Hey, here's our you know, Facebook page. Book us at your club.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tried to explain how much more complicated it used to be, you know, sending tapes and calling on the right day and all of this kind of
stuff. I mean, I can remember, I can just remember going from payphone to payphone in truck stops in the middle of nowhere, you know, confirming shows, you know, getting directions. I mean, just getting directions, pulling into a city that you've never been in before and not having your cell phone to get you exact, you know, right to the club. I mean, you know, we used to have a Rand McNally Road Atlas.
Those old triptychs from AAA. You ever say those things? And just reaching people. I mean, like, if I needed to reach you guys out somewhere at some club, it's like, well, good luck. I mean, you can call the place and maybe they'd answer the phone, maybe they'd get you, but it's like it's a serious crapshoot now. It's like everyone has a cell phone. It's unbelievable.
Yeah,
you know, I'm like the old guy, you know, like, that's what I said during that interview. I was like, oh, I'm like the old guy, all impressed with technology, but like, wow. I mean, it just seems like it would be so much easier now. But I guess maybe it's oversaturated or something, and this
very conversation, it would have to be at a college radio station that we drove, you know, 1,500 miles to get to.
That's true.
You know, to do this, to reach people, so... There you go.
That's a good point. A little bit. The last time I heard any new music from you was that Weather Band record that you did, and that was, what, like almost 10 years ago or so.
Yeah, it was 10 years ago. It was released in 2004.
Okay, so that was the last thing. Now, was that the last project you worked on prior to getting involved with Winchester Revival?
Well, I mean, in terms of actually releasing anything, I mean, I've played around, played out in different places by myself or with a couple other people. I've written a lot, and I've got a stockpile of songs that I will get to. I want to do a full-length record in the next couple years. But life happened, and I had kids and all that. So.
Now, what was the idea behind the name The Weather Band? I mean, why not just call it your own? You mean, was it a solo thing, right? Or was that actually a thing?
Well, it was really me, but I had a lot of other musicians, and the idea was that it would be a very flexible band, both recording and live. So on the Weather Band record, there's a couple songs that are just me with an acoustic guitar, and then there are some songs that have, a dozen people playing on them. And the idea was sort of, okay, well, I could play shows solo, or I could play shows, kind of whoever I could get together, and depending on the venue and depending on the situation. So it was sort of meant to be a flexible, fluid band. And the weather concept sort of fed into that. I think I wanted to call it The Weather, but there was somebody called The Weather or something like that.
I was thinking maybe we could just kind of go through some of the old Hue records and maybe discuss your thoughts on them these days, like what you still think. Like, actually, today I pulled out the White record, the self-titled EP, which I hadn't heard in a long time. I was without a turntable for about 2 years, so that contributed to it, of course. But, pulled that one out today. Sounded great. Hadn't heard it in a really long time. Let's, of course, just start with the stuff that, that includes me once I got involved. starting off with the first single, with Crush, what do you recall about that, about the single and the way everything turned out?
Oh, boy. I have to really jog my memory here. So we recorded that at a studio that I can't remember the name of. And that was a Baite-written song. Anderson, who, by the way, lives in Thailand now. He teaches at a university there. He's been there for a couple of years. And Crush was backed with Henry's Daughter, is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, here's my true confession time. I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I don't like the song Crush. I never have. I've always really not liked it. I think we might have discussed it. And, I love Baite's stuff on the album, on New York Era. I think his stuff was great, and his playing was great, et cetera. But that's the one song that I just didn't like. But at the time, I don't think I felt like I could, force you guys to make a change and say, no, we're going to do a different song. I just, it wasn't in my mentality to kind of be like, you know what, no.
Yeah. Well, maybe if you had, we would have had a real hit. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I know. So there you go. I fucked it up. Sorry about that. But it's always been this weird thing because it's like that record is real meaningful to me because it was the first release that I ever did, and yet it also is sort of tainted to me also at the same time because I like the other side better, the B-side better, and never really liked that one song. But anyway, it's true confession time. That was the...
I think that there was probably some... And I don't know if Baite would feel this way, too. I mean, I think we're trying to – there's probably some compromise going on in the band trying to bring Baite front and center with with his writing. And I don't think it's his strongest song. I mean, I think a couple of the songs on the record that he did, Cherry Bomb comes to mind, were way stronger than Crush.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But his guitar playing on it is pretty awesome. And so that was cool. But, yeah, I mean, I barely remember Henry's Daughter. I got to get a digital copy of it because that was a pretty – I remember liking that song, though, and think it was pretty cool.
It was. It was like – it sounded sort of like it still had when you guys were doing the more lo-fi thing when it still had, that kind of vibe, more like Church of Jose or something like that. Like it had that kind of vibe to it, which is what I think I like. Now, the first album, You Were Here – we put out 1995. Great album. But unfortunately, as you remember, after it was done, you know, this band is a totally different lineup at this point because, you know, Biate left. And I don't even remember the guy. Who was the guy who was playing bass for a little while?
Andre. Andre Vogel.
Yeah.
Who oddly also lives in Thailand, but not because Biate is there. They just both ended up there.
I think I witnessed him being fired. Didn't
who Andre
didn't he? If I this is how I remember it. I remember being in San Francisco for a release show for maybe the single, maybe the album. It's hard for me to remember at this point. And I think like that Andre did something like he sat down or something when he was playing. And I remember Baite getting mad at him and yelling at him or something. Or I mean, I couldn't hear what he was saying obviously over the music, but seemed to be pissed off, and I felt like, yeah, like I think he got canned after that. Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, I mean, now that you're mentioning it, I mean, I think Biate fired him, and just,
yeah.
You know, Biate had he was very young, and, and he'd probably laugh about I'm sure he'd laugh about it now, you know, but, you know, and he had very purist notions of what, you know, you do and don't do in a band, and, you know, so...
When was the last time you listened to that album, to the Your Hero?
You Are Here, I don't know, probably a year or two. I mean, I listen to it sometimes.
Yeah.
It's in there. There's some really, it's like really raw, you know? It's very, emotionally very raw. I mean, it's the, you know, for me, writing the songs that I wrote on it, you know, it was the, you know, I mean, there were several albums like this, but, you know,
yeah.
Quintessential 20-something, you know, lost love angst, you know, and that's all the stuff that I was feeling and going through at that time, and you know, and drugs, and were.
Now, do you have enough distance from it now where you can sort of look back and be like, you know, I really did kind of capture that, like that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but well, you've got enough distance from it and everything. It's like it's almost like you're just, you know. Like it almost like it happened to someone else. Like it's now captured in this music.
Yeah. Well, no, it didn't happen to somebody else. I mean, that's the thing about like, I know. I mean, the songs do, not all of them, but like the songs that are, you know, some of the songs still, for me, still resonate. And, like, it takes me right back into what I was feeling at that time. And that's the really powerful thing about songwriting, is that it's like, you know, the same reason that people write in their journals or whatever, but on steroids, because it's got all the senses engaged, but, you know, if it's a song that was well written and was truthfully written, then it'll bring me right back into that feeling. And it's like, oh, you know, that's pretty cool. It kind of, you know, teleports you 20
yeah.
years.
Well, it's great. I mean, I still listen to it, and it just, like, part of me is just like, wow, this was really, really good. And then it makes me mad that it didn't, you know, that it didn't resonate on a bigger level at the time, you know?
Yeah.
Because to put that up, the record against so many other records, what was that out in, like, what, 95, 94, 95?
Mm-hmm.
And just thinking of some of the other records that were out at that time, and that people look back and say, oh, this is a great album of the 90s, and I'm like, yeah, but that Q record was much better, you know? And it's unfortunate that's, you know, and that's partly just me, and I'm biased to some degree, but I do think that, you know, it was a tough time. There was so much music coming out at that time.
There always is. I mean, what I've, I don't know if it's resignation, resigned myself to, or actually really, you know, like I was saying before, I mean, for me as a songwriter, it's different for you because you were putting money into it and putting it out. And believe me, at the time, you know, I wanted it to do a lot more than it did. And I still want my records to reach a bigger audience.
Yeah.
Of course. But yeah. to me, the value of writing and making records is the personal experience. I mean, and that's, you know, it really is. And I don't think that I quite understood that back then.
Yeah. Well, it was a learning experience for everyone, it seems. So moving on to the next record was Lucky Drive. And then John came into the band, John Murray. Mm-hmm. And the band again, I mean, it was really different. That was the band that toured in support of You Are Here. So it was already a different group than had the album. What do you remember about that album, and how do you think it stands up today?
Well, so it was recorded, you know, You Are Here was recorded at Greg Freeman's studio, Lowdown, which was a great studio. It sat exactly where first base sits at AT&T Park, where the Giants play now. So it no longer exists. We recorded on 2-inch, and it was, you know, it was a real studio. We recorded Lucky Drive at Vac Daddy, which was Steve Fulta's studio, who's a great engineer, but it was much more lo-fi, right? We were recording to quarter-inch A-track, the old Fostex machine. And so it's actually a lot more lo-fi than You Are Here. It was pretty fun and kind of liberating, just like the band dynamic was, because it was new. We had some at the time, I think, creative and personality conflicts in the old hue, and so this was kind of liberating. And it was a show that we could take on the road, and we had a great live dynamic together, and just a great time together doing those, I don't know how many tours we did, a bunch.
Yeah, a lot.
You know, the songs on Lucky Drive are less, you know, like gut-wrenching emo. I think that
right.
they're a little bit lighter fare. They're a little bit, you know, I was probably stretching out a little bit as a songwriter. John brought a lot of levity. I mean, stuff he was into is like more psychedelic. He was, you know, he was into the Flaming Lips when Flaming Lips played for nobody. I mean, he was like one of their earliest fans and was a diehard Flaming Lips fan. And he really turned me on to Flaming Lips. And that injected kind of like a sense of psychedelia and kind of silliness into what we were doing, which is very different than kind of the emotionally laden, you know, kind of angrier stuff that we were doing before. Like, we weren't, the new Hugh was not an angry Hugh at all.
So then you move on to the next record, to the Brave Little Soldier record, which the Swan Song. I mean, nobody knew it at the time, I guess, but that ended up being the Swan Song. How about that one?
Hey, hey,
that
don't count it out yet, because I have some news for you at the end of this conversation. So it may not have been the Swan Song. Yeah.
Okay.
We toured a lot, John Gavin and I, and we toured hard. And we kind of just burned ourselves out, and you know, and I think that there was tension at the end, mainly between Gavin and John, and it just stopped being fun, and it just wasn't working. I think it was largely just like road fatigue.
Yeah,
you know?
Just burnout.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you bring in, Ian came in to do what was the touring on that record. And, give me some thoughts on the album how recently have you listened to it?
Yeah, I mean, I listened to that, I don't know, you know, within the last year. I've played it for my, I think I've probably played all of them for my boys. You know, that record kind of combines some of the elements of the first two. It's definitely, for me, I think, more mature, you know, songwriting.
Yeah.
We went back to Lowdown, so we recorded in a big, you know, in a real studio. We had other people come in and help us with the recording. So the recording sounds really good. There are some kind of emotionally, there's some, like, what I like about some of the songs is that they have space. And so we brought in the psychedelia, but not in a silly way, but more in a, you know, Pink Floyd way, you know, something where we brought back some of the emotional. I think there's some of the same emotional songwriting that was in the first record, but this is a little bit more refined.
Yeah,
there's some you know, more sort of Flaming Lipsy, Bowie, silly songs in there too, like that song pretty good pop song, or pop song, whatever it's called, which kind of bugs
good
me
pop
actually.
Song.
Yeah, that song bugs me actually.
I'll tell you, whatever, Jupiter's Gone in Albuquerque, so
yeah,
and I mean, that's good. To me, those are the two best ones.
I got lost in Albuquerque. She had good direction, but I left her in a suit. Bringing me down the whole way. Since then I've been aching for weightless expression, words beyond her. But you know, her blood's filled the same well from the start. Changes go on, see them through. You can blame me
So do you want to hear about the lost recording, or do you want to ask something?
Well, no.
First?
I mean, my only other questions were really I was going to ask you. Well, what the heck happened to Gavin? I haven't heard from him since the late '90s.
After Hugh, he played with John Vanderslice for a few years, toured with him. JV has gone on to make quite a name for himself.
He's played here a number of times.
He was a hired gun for this kind of middle of the road rocker, Matt Nathanson. You ever heard of that guy?
The name sounds kind of familiar. I can't say like I've heard the music or anything for sure, but
yeah. So Gavin kind of sessioned out and whored himself out. No, I'm just kidding. to a couple bands. It's funny because when he was, I just as an aside, I know that when he was with Vanderslice, I know that they toured with Spoon, and they toured with, I think they toured with Death Cab, when Death Cab was sort of in its earliest ascendancy.
Wow.
So he has some stories about that stuff. But yeah, then he went to get his PhD at Notre Dame. And he now is a professor. He just got tenure like a month ago at Concordia University in Montreal. So he lives in Montreal with his wife, and they have a daughter.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So what Gavin brought up to me was what he calls the lost recordings. And I hadn't forgotten about them. I just hadn't really thought about them. And one of the last Hugh tours with Ian, we camped ourselves out at my family farm in Wisconsin and recorded what was going to be the next record. And we just never finished it because we called it quits after that tour.
Right.
So Gavin really wants to finish it. And he's got, the basic tracks are done. So I need to do the vocals and, maybe add some more guitars and stuff like that.
So, how many songs did you get?
I can't remember. I don't know. I don't know if it's a full album or short of a full album's worth. There's a bunch of songs on there, and some of them are pretty good. So we're going to try to, kind of finish those off.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So maybe it wasn't the swan song.
It may not have been. It may not
never
have been.
Know. So, after the band ended, at the end of the '90s, and that kind of coincided, the label ended around, by 2000, I was completely finished with Mafia Money. What was your next move right after that? Because I know my next move was to completely abandon the whole, indie music world and everything, and I kind of lost touch with everybody, and I totally take responsibility for losing touch because I wasn't consciously doing it, but I kind of did just sort of move away from that whole chapter because I was really depressed. What did you do right after Hugh ended?
Well, before Hugh ended, I had started what was originally going to be an online indie record store. And, kind of at the time it was like, this is, I think, before even Amazon, it was like CD Now and Music Boulevard. And I wanted to do something more sort of focused on independent music. And as part of that, and this is going to be online, right?
Yeah.
And as part of that, I wanted to do an e-zine, that kind of promoted stuff that we thought was cool, kind of curated, did record reviews, Well, the technology for the shopping cart technology and trying to get the store off the ground it took forever and it was really hard. But the magazine, which was called Inkblot Magazine, did really well and ended up getting like a whole bunch of traffic. And, we did interviews with lots of cool bands. And I kind of assembled an army of volunteer writers and got this thing going. And then that, this was now getting into the late 90s. That launched in like, I was working on that in 97 when the band was still happening.
Okay.
And it launched in 98. And then that sort of morphed into a company that I founded called Music Fans at musicfans.com. And the idea behind Music Fans was that there were all these independent music sites, mainly fan sites devoted to a single artist that were not the official site, but, oftentimes had larger audiences than the official site. So we, I brought on a partner who, you know, was like a Wharton MBA and had just left Microsoft, and, you know, we raised a bunch of money. We raised like $5 million, $6 million.
Wow.
And launched this thing, and you know, basically aggregated or acquired 120 websites. And it was like everything from the largest Radiohead site, the largest U2 site, to like the 50 Cent site, you know, Garth Brooks, you know, like across the musical spectrum. And it was this like full business. I went from playing in Hue and touring in a van to running a company with, you know, 40 people. Like in the course of 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And that set me on a path of doing internet startups, of either founding or running internet startups, really until just a few years ago when I changed course again.
And what are you doing these days?
I run an environmental nonprofit. I've been kind of obsessed with climate change and wanting to do something about it. And after being essentially in the music business my entire adult life, either as a musician or doing these internet things, I jumped ship and, did a couple things. And now I'm running a nonprofit called the Climate Registry. And, so
wow.
Very different.
The Climate Registry, and you're in D.C.,
Yeah, well, I still live in San Francisco or near San Francisco. The Climate Registry is based in L.A., so I'm in L.A. a lot. And I travel all around the world, really, to work on this stuff. But this week I'm in Washington.
And that'll wrap up podcast number 115, the interview with Dave Rosenheim. Again, look for Winchester Revival on their Bandcamp page. That's where you can pick up their music, sign up for their mailing list so they can notify you when future stuff comes out. Make sure, if you like this podcast, to like us on Facebook. We're facebook.com/thedarkstuffpodcast. If you want to find me on Twitter, I am at Dave Splash. On the next episode, number 116, I will be interviewing Orenda Fink. Orenda Fink is a very, very talented artist, singer-songwriter, who's been making records for about 15 years. She records for Saddle Creek Records. She used to live down south, now lives up in Omaha where I live. She has a brand new album out called Blue Dream. I imagine we'll be talking quite a bit about that. All right, everybody, thanks a lot for listening. This has been the Dark Stuff Podcast.
Transfer of data is complete.